the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
On the third day, he will be raised to life. That's the backdrop, that's the setting. And then comes our passage. Then, the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favour of him. "What is it you want?" he asked. She said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit on you at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said to them. "Can you drink the cup I am going to drink?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father." When the ten heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And then the next verses are interesting too. As Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. Two blind men were sitting by the roadside, and when they heard that Jesus was passing by, they shouted, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." The crowd rebuked them and told them to be quiet, but they shouted all the louder, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." Jesus stopped and called them. "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. "Lord," they answered, "we want our sight." Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes. Immediately, they received their sight and followed him. Well, the subject we've got this morning is Jesus, King of the Ambitious. I was wondering last night just how to introduce it when I came across a news story that really sounded quite fascinating. On Thursday, Vittorio Santa Monica was buried in Rome. He was a mafia boss, and he was buried at a large church on the east side of Rome with the most incredible razzmatazz. This is the carriage that the coffin was carried in. 500 people went to the funeral. A helicopter came low overhead, scattering rose petals. The pilot has now lost his license as a result of that, but there you go. There were other people on florist wagons scattering flowers all over the place. The whole thing was a massive, massive production. It must have cost a fortune. And the really interesting thing, it seems to me, was the fact that the church was festooned in posters outside saying things like this: "Vittorio Casamonica, Re di Roma, King of Rome." And the one that really interested me: "You have conquered Rome, now you're on your way to conquer paradise." I thought, ambitious. Well, that's ambitious for you. And it just sums up, doesn't it, the way in which some people try to make themselves big. He had nothing to write home about Casamonica. If I had been him, I think I'd have kept very quiet about my record at the end of my life. He was involved in racketeering, fraud, corruption, intimidation, all sorts of things. There's been a whole series of high-profile cases in Rome over the last year and a half of officials in senior positions who've been turfed out of their jobs because they've been found to have been bribed by people like Casamonica. And he's somebody who has lived a dirty, dirty life. And yet, he just wanted to be top. And even in death, the mafia are saying, "We're still here. We're still in charge. Forget about who's officially running Italy. It's us." Ambition can be a really ugly thing sometimes. And you see it all over life, don't you? You see it in all kinds of places. And so this morning we're talking about Jesus, King of the Ambitious. James and John were ambitious. They wanted to make the most of themselves just as much as a mafia gangster might. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's bad, but ambition is a feature of life. And it's something that leaves us often wondering if it's all it's cracked up to be, if it's worthwhile. Alexander the Great, I suppose, was one of the most ambitious people in history. His empire was the biggest the world had ever seen at that point, 3,000 miles from one side to the other. He'd taken over the Babylonian Empire, the Persian, the empire of the Medes and Persians. He'd conquered Egypt. He just brought the whole thing together in one massive empire. And of course, the famous quotation about him is this: when Alexander saw the breadth of his domain, he wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer. He just lived for conquering things, and now there was nothing left. Actually, that's not true. This is the fake, corrupt version of the quotation. What Plutarch, the historian who gave us that story, really said was this: Alexander wept when he heard from Anaxagoras that there was an infinite number of worlds, and his friends asking him if any accident had befallen him, he returned this answer: "Do you not think it is a matter worthy of lamentation that where there is such a vast multitude of them, of worlds, we have not yet conquered one?" In other words, a feeling of just wanting to do more, go further, do something bigger. And we all know what that feels like. We're all ambitious in different ways. If somebody says, "Oh, I'm not ambitious at all," they're probably wrong. Because ambition is just two things, if you think about it. One, an urge to change things in some kind of a way. And two, an urge to be involved in that. You want to be part of the change. That's what ambition is. And so I say it can be good or it can be bad. You can use it for wrong purposes or right purposes. But we all have it one way or another. Sometimes people say, "Oh, I'm not ambitious. I'm too old to be ambitious." You must be joking. Some of the old people I know are some of the most ambitious people in the world. And I think the older you get, the more you sense that there's a new generation coming up and they can do things that you can't do, and they do it with an energy that you don't have any longer. And you get worried about your territory. And you want to be in charge. You want to be doing things. And you're ambitious to at least hang on to what you've got, if not to move it forward. Sometimes people, "I'm not ambitious because I work in the church." Oh, my. You know, you look at the history of the church down through the centuries, and you'll find that whatever job people have got, it can be a mask for ambition and greed and self-vaunting in any kind of a way. I think one of the most revealing jobs I ever did for Paternoster Press here in Exeter was to work on manuscripts for a body called the World Evangelical Fellowship, which brings together theologians from around the world to write important books and have important conferences. At least they think they're important. I think I saw more vanity and pride and self-preening in that group of individuals than anywhere else I've ever come across it. Ambition can rule anywhere. And sometimes people say, "Well, I'm not ambitious because I'm not involved in anything big. You know, I have a small job and I live in a small way and my name's never in the papers. You couldn't call me ambitious." But you can be ambitious in small areas. There are all sorts of petty tyrants and pocket Hitlers all over the place who just want to exert their will over other people. And the people, too, in small situations who use their ambition well. There's good ambition as well as bad ambition. I think of Charles Sims, who bullied the elders of this church into building a place this big back in the 1950s. It was too big for those days. And the story goes, Charles told me once, John Lang, the architect, walked around this place at the opening in 1956 and he realized, "It is so big, I do hope you'll fill it." And right from the first day, Belmont Chapel was comfortably full. And since then, we've had to expand and get bigger. And it's just because of the vision and the ambition of a man who was just a small town GP, whose name is not known in the wider world, although he made quite an impact on his generation, but who is ambitious for God to see something happening here. So ambition pokes its head up all over the place. And even if you're not very ambitious, that's probably because you're scared of being ambitious. There's a great passage in Ecclesiastes chapter 4 that talks about what's wrong with human ambition. And it says, you know, as Ecclesiastes looks around, he thinks that what he sees is that all that people achieve, all that they strive for, all of their efforts are for their own gratification. He's not right. He's making one of the provisional judgments that you get all the way through Ecclesiastes, but he comes to a pretty bitter conclusion. And then there's a really interesting verse that talks about what ambition does to you. He says this: "I saw that all toil and all achievement spring from one person's envy of another. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." Now, he's going to qualify that judgment later on in the book, but he says this: "Fools fold their hands and ruin themselves. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind." What he's saying is ambition can send you in one of two directions. Either it can send you chasing after the wind, looking for another handful to add to what you've got already. And that's stupid and meaningless and passing and not worthwhile, he says. But there's the other side of it as well. Fools fold their hands and ruin themselves. He's talking there about people who just give up. People who say, the risk of reach is too much for me. If I'm ambitious, I'll get hurt, so I won't bother. Douglas Copeland, the Canadian novelist, wrote a book a few years ago called Generation X, about the last but one generation of young people. And in the margin of that book, he put all sorts of little definitions of things that he thought summed up their lifestyle. And one of those definitions was about Mac jobs. And he said, thousands of people all over the world are getting Mac jobs. What do I mean by that? Well, I'm talking about people who could be astrophysicists, could be brain surgeons, could be doing something big in the world. But, well, it takes so long. It's such a risky career. You might set your heart on something and not get it. Better not to try. And so he says, in this generation, people are just taking jobs in McDonald's, Mac jobs, working in a filling station, on the checkout at Tesco's, not because that's the best they can do, but because they just don't want to risk anymore in a hard, brutal, competitive world. So ambition will either drive you under or it will push you out. Either way, it's dangerous. So what are we saying about ambition this morning? Well, ambition is basically trying to be something you're not. And so the wrong ambition, which can happen in the service of God as much as anywhere else, is trying to make yourself bigger than everybody else. You find that in the prophet Elijah. Do you remember that when he had his nervous breakdown, he just had this incredible miracle on the top of Mount Carmel where his sudden sacrifice had caught a light and the sacrifice of the priests of Baal wouldn't light whatever they tried. If you don't know the story, 1 Kings 16 to 18 is where you'll find the whole thing. And Elijah had a tremendous moment of triumph, and then he had a message from the queen. I'm going to kill you. Now, that was exactly what he could have expected, but it was one pressure too many. And under the strain, his nerve broke, and he just ran. And he ran to the other end of the country. He fell asleep. An angel fed him. Eventually, after he was back in his right mind, God met him again. And God said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And Elijah has a little speech, which he's obviously been thinking about for a long time, because he gives it twice to God. It's exactly the same wording. So you know it's something he's thought out in his head. This is what I will say to God. And part of it is this: "Take away my life, O Lord, for I am no better than my fathers." What's he saying? He's saying, I thought I was going to be the big one in the Elijah family tree. I thought that when people looked at the family album in future, they'd be going through the pictures and, oh yes, there's Aunt Jemima, she was a bit batty. Oh, there's Uncle Eliezer, he never mentioned anything much. Ah, now this one, that's Elijah. He's our great ancestor. He was the biggest one. And Elijah's found that he's no better than his father's. He's just the same as everybody else. And his ambition, rather than God, is what's let him down. So ambition can be a dangerous thing. And it leads to disillusion if you're not careful as well. This statue in the sands of Egypt, once in 1818, influenced Shelley to write a poem. And he wrote about how the statue just lies there in the sand, a few legs, a face and a trunk and so on. And then he says this at the end of the poem. "And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." And then Shelley says, "Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." Somebody who said, "Look on my works and despair. Nobody can be bigger or better than I am." And his works have just crumbled away and left him behind. Woody Allen has written about a thing called the Ozymandias Melancholia. And he's made two films about it. And he says, Ozymandias Melancholia is the depression you get when you have the realization that your works of art will not save you and will mean nothing down the line. What have you been working for? What has your life achieved? What have you left behind? Nothing that will endure your own death. It's all going to crumble away and leave you. And he says it's a perfectly valid description of a particular phenomenon. It's that sad and depressed feeling you get when you realize that no matter how great and majestic and important something is at the time, in time it's going to pass. Just like the poem, eventually time kills everything. It's just that rotting statue of Ozymandias, a once great statue, now a broken down piece of marble in the desert. So you get a depressed feeling, he says, because it gives you a sense of the futility of life. That all that you're working for and all the things that seem so meaningful are nothing. So let's look at the passage and let's just talk about three things in it. First of all, what ambitious thinking is. Second, the trouble with ambition, the downside of ambition. And third, what Jesus says kingdom ambitions should be. That's where we're going. First of all, ambitious thinking. What is it like to think ambitiously about yourself in the James and John kind of a way? Well, I guess there were four main components to the philosophy that they were showing at this point. First of all, make the most of how you look. Appearance is everything. The big thing is how you can put yourself forward. Just make the most positive statement about yourself. Can you drink from the cup that I drink from? Yes, we can. We can do anything. Jesus, we're your best followers. You can count on us. We're good. Bring your mum along. You know, apply the nostalgia factor. Clearly, it wasn't her idea. I used to read this passage and think, oh, yes, Jewish mothers always pushing the children forward. But actually, in one of the other Gospels that tells the same story, you find that it just talks about James and John. It doesn't talk about mum at all. So mum was there for window dressing. And clearly, it wasn't her idea. She'd come along simply because they thought that she'd be good value to have alongside them. She was one of the women that used to follow Jesus, help the disciples out financially, do all sorts of things for them. And so that would be part of the dressing, part of the package. Ambition means sometimes making yourself look better than you actually are. Don Draper in Mad Men, for example, the guy in the picture there. He's somebody who just stands for that kind of thing, isn't he? Because nobody really knows about him. One of the other characters says at one point, Don Draper, nobody knows about him. He might be Batman as far as anybody knows. And in actual fact, his backstory is much less impressive than he pretends it is. He was born the son of a drunkard and a prostitute. He was dragged up through, handed on like a parcel through a series of relatives who didn't really want to look after him. He's got all sorts of skulls and bodies in the closet. He's done all sorts of things in his life that he's not very proud of. And yet, he comes across as looking sort of much, much better than he actually is. Second thing, if you don't ask, you don't get. Okay, somebody's got to be sitting at Jesus' right hand and left hand. He's got a kingdom, right? So he's going to have a throne. That means he's going to sit on it. That means there's going to be a space on one side and a space on the other. That means two people. Ah, well, we don't want Peter and Andrew to get it. Let's jump in first and make our bid. If you don't ask, you don't get. Third part of the philosophy, cash in any favours you can. Mum has done so much for the disciples. She's such a good woman, all that washing and cleaning and mending and ironing. And if we put her on our side and get her to say good things for us, then Jesus might feel under a sense of obligation. Oh, well, you know, these guys, they really have been with me a long time. They are some of my best friends. Okay, let's give them the job. And fourth, go straight for the top. Don't let go for any secondary goal. Go for the big one. We want to be on a throne. We don't want just to be given titles or land or something like that. We want to sit right next to you. We want your glory to rub off on us. We want the top position. And that's a common philosophy, let's face it, in our world today, isn't it? Where more and more we're buying into the myth that you can do anything you want. If you just try hard enough, you can get to the top. It's just a matter of living out your dreams, working hard, and then anybody can be anything. That's the philosophy that lies behind the popularity of, I don't know, American Idol, all of those shows that take somebody from nowhere and put them up there. A philosophy that says you can be whatever you want to be, you just have to be determined enough. And it's not true, but people believe it. If you want a quote from Game of Thrones, King Robert Baratheon said, "I was never so alive as when I was winning this throne, or so dead as now that I've won it." When you get to the top, what's there left if that's the way you put yourself there? And that leads us on to the trouble with ambition. What's wrong with ambition? Well, there are various things. First of all, it means you have to manipulate people. That's basically what James and John were trying to do with Jesus, wasn't it? They were trying to get something out of him, not for Jesus' good, but for their own purposes. And so they were trying to manipulate his emotions, manipulate his feelings, put him into a position where he was embarrassed. And they would say, well, yes, oh, okay, all right, you can have that position. They wanted to jump the gun. They wanted to push Jesus into doing something that Jesus didn't want to do. Second, you upset people. What did they think the other disciples were going to think? If the other disciples had come back from their trip away and Jesus said, boys, I have an announcement for you. I've decided that when I come into my kingdom, James and John will be sitting on thrones on either side of me. Why? They asked. But what about us? Well, I'm sorry, they asked first. They're not going to be thrilled, are they? They're not going to dance about, woohoo, James and John are going to be sitting on thrones and we're going to be groveling in the dirt. course they're not. They wanted to be up there too. And the trouble with ambition is that it tends to mean that you have to push people out of the way. And third, you lose touch with reality. I mean, they could have thought about that. What will the other disciples think? We're not going to be flavor of the month. Can you drink from the cup I'm going to drink, says Jesus. And remember, he's just told them in a few verses before, the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests, condemned to death, handed over, flogged, crucified. Can you drink from that cup? And they say, oh, we don't know what cup you're talking about. Yeah, bring it on, we'll take it. They didn't know what they were talking about. And ambition can push us, therefore, into situations that we just can't cope with. I remember one leading ex-civil servant who often comes here to do things for us, who was important in the John Major government a few years ago, telling me about somebody he knew who ran a major utility. That is about all I can say, really, without getting accused of, you know, into the libel courts or something like that. And he said, I don't know how that man got the job. It must just be people he knew, because he couldn't organise anything. And here's a man who's controlling a major system, that's all I'll say, in Britain, promoted way beyond his abilities. Why? Just because he was ambitious and pushy, and he got there. So ambition creates problems. And I put that picture of Las Vegas up beside that last slide because one of the sad stories of the last few years has been about the downtown project in Las Vegas in America. A man called Tony Hsieh had started it to bring happiness to Las Vegas. It's a massive, ambitious restructuring of the whole urban area. And he wrote a book called Delivering Happiness, A Path to Profits, Passion and Purpose. And he believed that the ambition of people, if you harnessed it properly, to build their own businesses and make themselves rich, could bring happiness to the whole city. And they hit the news earlier on this year when it turned out that three of the leading entrepreneurs had all, one after another, committed suicide. The happiness it was supposed to bring doesn't seem to have arrived. One analyst who has worked with the families and observed the whole thing said this: the difference here in this project is the focus on happiness. That's a goal. But if we negate the negative emotions in our lives, it takes us away from happiness and brings around shame. The whole idea of downtown, the project, is grand and wonderful and purposeful, but sometimes the way we're going about it isn't psychologically healthy. And she said, the pressures are the lack of being able to confide with people, having to put on a vest or a mask, and having to say everything's great. Ambition, pushing yourself out there, getting yourself into a position you've never been in before and you're maybe not capable for, it brings stresses and pressures into your life that you're not equipped to deal with. And it can lead to disaster. But there's good ambition as well as bad ambition. I've said this all the way through. So in our last couple of minutes, let's just have a look at the third issue. Kingdom ambition. Jesus says, not all ambition is wrong. And it is interesting, isn't it, that immediately after this little story that we're looking at this morning, you get the two blind men by the side of the road. Now, they're ambitious, if anybody is. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy. Shush, you be quiet. Jesus, Son of David, you're far too dirty for him to speak to you. Oh, you smell. Shut up and go away. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy. And then Jesus comes across to them and asks them a big question. What do you want me to do for you? Now, that's appealing to ambition, isn't it? Will you sign this autograph for my sister? Have you got any money, spare change? You know, I could do with a bed for the night. No, they went for the big one. We want our sight back. And in the right context, ambition is not wrong. And to ask God for the biggest, most audacious thing you can possibly be involved in is not wrong. Thou art coming to a king, says the old hymn. Large petitions with thee bring, for his grace and power are such, none can ever ask too much. What sort of ambitions are we supposed to have? I think there are three things you can see in this passage, and with this I'll finish. First of all, kingdom ambition means an ambition to see God's glory, not ours. Because as Ozymandias teaches us, whatever you build, it's going to crumble, it's going to decay, it's going to fade. Even your own reputation, you can build it up to a glittering eminence, and then in the next generation, people are going to come along and criticize it and knock it and question whether you quite were the people that everybody thought you were, and so on and so forth. There is nothing you can build in this world that is lasting. The only thing that will remain is what you build for the kingdom of God, for God's glory. Because if he is the center of the universe, if he is its creator, if he is the one around whom the whole thing revolves, then the more glory he gets, the more the purpose of the universe is fulfilled. And so to try to say, no, me, I want to be big, I want the glory, is working against the whole way that creation is going. And when you fit in with God's plans for the future and you bring glory to him and you fall in love with Jesus Christ and you just want to serve him for the rest of your life, then you know what happiness and fulfilled ambition are really all about. Second thing, an ambition to serve others. There's an old chorus he used to sing in Sunday school. It goes, J-O-Y, J-O-Y, surely this must mean Jesus first, yourself last, and others in between. And there's a good biblical basis to that. If you're serving the one who was himself the servant of others, then you share his passion, you share his heartbeat, you give yourself for other people as well. And so serving God means serving other people too. It's impossible to serve God and to build the kingdom of God without giving yourself to other people. And in honor, preferring others before yourself, as the New Testament put it. Now, that doesn't mean you do yourself down. Oh, I am unworthy, I'm useless, I'm hopeless. They're all much better than me. No, they're not. But that's the very discipline, isn't it? Seeing people who can't do what you can. People who don't have the advantages you have. People whose opinions you don't 100% agree with. And serving them thoughtfully all the same. That's what it's all about. Putting yourself willingly in the position of a servant, just as Jesus did. Next week, I have to speak about Philippians in Germany, and I've been working on Philippians 2 quite a bit. That tremendous hymn about Jesus, do you remember? Who thought it not an advantage, not something to be grasped after, not something that he must hang on to at all costs to be equal with God, but took on himself the form of a servant, humbled himself, became obedient to death, the death of the cross. And for us, he despised the shame. For us, he came to earth in the first place. For us, he rose again. Jesus did all of that for you and for me. And if I'm a follower of his, then my attitude to others will be the same as his. And the final thing, obviously, is an ambition to come last and be unnoticed except by God. Nothing I do will be to draw attention to myself. Nothing I do will be so that people will notice me and say nice things about me. Oh, it's good when they do, and I mustn't be falsely humble about that. But at the same time, that's not what I build myself on. I don't live my life around the strokes that other people give me. Because if I do that, I become neurotically dependent on other people's approval. As it is, I live only so that I can do the will of God. That can be fulfilled through me, and I can go unnoticed except by a master who will say, well done, you good and faithful servant. That's not normal human ambition, is it? But it's healthy, it's right, it's the proper way to go. And James and John didn't understand it, but in the course of time, they would. And if you go on into their history and the way that their life developed, you see two men who at the end of their lives had got it. Who'd understood how ambition should be properly shepherded and channeled in your life so that it brings about what's going to honor God, help others, and fulfill you. And we can learn from them too. Let's just pray to finish with, shall we? So, Heavenly Father, some of us are ambitious. Some of us are high flyers. Some of us are not. But we all know what it's like to feel inside. Things should be different, and I should be part of making it different. We all have ambitions of one kind or another. Shepherd and school those ambitions for us, Father, through the power of your Holy Spirit. Tame and temper the restless pride inside us. Make us people who are prepared to commit ourselves to following the values of the kingdom, putting ourselves last, putting others before ourselves and putting on the throne in the center and not worrying about who's sitting on right hand or left hand, the Lord Jesus Christ himself. We remember how Paul summed it up in one of his letters. We make it our aim to please him. Make that the watchword of our lives this week, we ask, for your name's sake.